Is there any way to resolve this side effect?
Well, that really isn't my problem. See, my brief was to find a way to compress ads to stop channel switching. I mean, I only invent the bomb, I don't drop it.
Yes, well, unfortunately, Edison Carter nearly stumbled onto the incident. And if people knew about this...
Well, then don't tell them.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A military coup in Washington with a war crime suspect general in charge of the White House, but they won't tell you that on the BBC. Who and what is John Kelly, the US Army General, who's Trump's new Chief of Staff? Are there any Trump supporters left in the White House now? And Amnesty brings out a shocking report about Iran's courts jailing human rights campaigners. Meanwhile, after being elected as a pro-Russia ticket, on the pro-Russia ticket, Trump has sheepishly signed into laws new sanctions, ramping up economic war with Russia. We hear from former US Senate foreign policy advisor James Jatras why the Cold War is back, the only question being how long until it goes hot. And as part of our series in the run-up to the 16th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks next month, we hear this week from the author of yet another book on 9/11 you won't find in Waterstones. He's William Stewart, and his book is entitled 9/11 to Armageddon, Bankers Plan Wars. It came out around the same time as airline pilot James Marshall's book, The Big Bamboozle, in 2012. And held over from last week, author E. Michael Jones on the US Black Jewish Alliance, the breakup around the time of the 1967 Six-Day War, where the Israeli army took over what's still known today as the Occupied Territories. Also a chance for Martin Summers to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. And our sister show Dialects back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Again, this week, Bristol's Radical History Group's Mark Steeds, the publican, on the last possible buildings Mayor Marvin Rees could allocate for Bristol's long-awaited slave trade history hub. Will the city finally face up to its past? That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you can't wait, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, what about this chap that's just taken over at the White House? He is a general that was in charge of Guantanamo Bay, in charge of force feeding at Guantanamo Bay. He was a general in the Iraq War, and also he was in charge of something called Southcom. What, pray tell, is Southcom?
Well, I imagine that must be looking after Latin America, I thought.
I think you might be right. And the Caribbean. Don't forget the Caribbean. Yeah. Looking after them. What do they
well,
mean?
Well, I mean, just being the enforcer for the Caribbean and Latin America.
Well, what actually is the US military's role in places like that these days?
Well, they're very serious.
I'm sure they shouldn't be there at all.
Well, you may argue that, but they certainly are there. They've got bases in Colombia. They've been kicked out of Ecuador. They've been very involved in, you know, hands-on involved in Latin American politics for over 100 years, so everybody in Latin America is extremely aware of the US role in their lives.
And are they well received?
No, not by the majority, but by the wealthy minorities in these countries. They see their allies in the US as essential to retain their privileges.
Now, there's been some big changes, haven't there? For example, in Brazil recently, over the last year
yes.
or so.
And we've got a potential civil war brewing in Venezuela. So, yes, the situation in Latin America, you've had left of centre governments running most of the big countries in Latin America for the last 10 years, but they are now being removed either through the ballot box or through other mechanisms because the economy is starting to falter as a result of collapsing oil and commodity prices. And of course, these countries are not socialist countries in the sense that they can protect themselves from that kind of market failure, and therefore, you know, there's an offensive being carried out by the ruling class in these various countries, allied with very powerful forces in the US.
What you're saying, it makes it sound like the ruling classes in most of these countries, in South America and possibly elsewhere, are actually acting against the interests of the people they're supposed to be serving.
Yes, that's pretty clear. I mean, during the Argentinian military dictatorship in the 1980s, which Britain supported until they invaded the Falkland Islands, 30,000 people were tortured to death. Those 30,000 people were mostly educated, they were lawyers, they were human rights workers, they were political activists. And when you finally do get a free vote at the end of all of that, don't forget that all the people you might have voted for are already dead. And people in Latin America are very well aware of the malign influence of the United States. And of course, the ruling classes in these countries spend half their time in Miami anyway. So, you know, they all speak English as a second language. They go on their holidays to the United States. They regard their fellow country people often with disgust and fear.
Well, there's a son of a Peruvian mine engineer decided to do something about it, didn't he? Alan Frankovich went to LA Film School and then started making films about what was happening. It started off with a film which focused on Latin America, although it looked all over the world, called Uncompany Business.
Well, that's right. I mean, the CIA, who are accusing Trump of this, that and the other as we speak, they are not an organisation that I would believe a word they said about anything. They have got a track record of torture, murder and manipulation. And in, you know, when the change comes that we all hope for, the CIA will be disbanded. Kennedy said, "I'm going to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces." That's what he said some months before he was assassinated.
What about other countries as well, though? Venezuela has been in the news this week, and that does look also as if it's quite a serious political knife-edge situation since the death of Chavez. What's been the American role there?
Well, many people on
the US role, because actually when you're in South America, they get annoyed if you say anything to do with America. No, it's the United States. We're America.
Well, many people on the Chavista side of things in Venezuela believe that Hugo Chavez was probably murdered by the CIA because he died of a very, very obscure kind of cancer. And in fact, many of the leaders, the Kirchner...
Poisoned, you mean?
Yeah, basically, what they did was they gave... The suggestion is that they... And they admit that they tried to do this with Castro. They don't admit that they tried to do it with the democratically elected leaders like Chavez. But many people in Latin America suspect that these people were actually murdered by the CIA. And, of course, Allende in 1973 definitely was murdered by the Chilean military working with the CIA.
Working with Henry Kissinger,
and of course British-supplied planes, Hawker Hunter planes, bombed the presidential palace.
But up to the present day, what about places like Bolivia and Ecuador?
Well, Bolivia and Ecuador and the Andean countries, apart from Peru, the left is much stronger because they're poorer countries and the ruling class is that much more, you know, it's just smaller. They haven't got such a big... In Venezuela, you've got a substantial section of the population that sees itself as middle class and upper class, and therefore sees itself as hostile to the Chavez regime. There have been attempts to remove the governments of Venezuela and of Bolivia and Ecuador as well. It's an ongoing struggle. I mean, what's happened in Venezuela is that the right-wing opposition held a so-called plebiscite, which the left-wing boycotted, and now the left-wing have held a constituent assembly election, which the right-wing have boycotted. And if you look at it, what you will see is that half the population supports the government and the other half is totally opposed to the government. And they've now started to set up their own elections where they can elect who they want to win. And they don't participate in the same elections that...
The US has been moving to sanction Venezuela this year.
They've been sanctioning Venezuela for a long time. And, of course, that's what the Chavistas Costa's claim is that the economy was already going down because of the oil price, but the sanctions against Venezuela have made life difficult
okay,
for ordinary
focus
people.
On Maduro's Venezuela and Morales's Bolivia. Where do you see them in a couple of years' time? Are the Americans going to get their
way? What I fear may happen in Venezuela is we're going to get either a coup from the right or an authoritarian government of the left, which will then be facing continuous... what's been going on is the people rebelling against the Maduro regime have not been acting peacefully. They've been attacking the police. They've been setting up roadblocks. They've been putting barbed wire across motorways, which have actually taken the heads off people who are driving. So, in other words, they tried during the election campaign on the election for the Constituent Assembly, which took place this week. The right wing were trying to stop people voting and using petrol bombs and so on, and of course the other side are retaliating. So in actual fact, the people that, but when they say so many people have been killed in Venezuela, they're not all being killed by the government. They're
like
also the protesters, just like in Syria and elsewhere, are using violent tactics to try and push their views.
Bolivia and Russia are both defending Venezuela's Constituent Assembly election. It seems as if there are certain people around the world, the usual suspects, that simply aren't going to accept this vote at all.
Well, that's right. And therefore, you could easily see a civil war developing in Venezuela just as one comes to an end in Colombia.
Anyway, you might wonder why we're focusing on South America, because Martin actually got my little quiz question right about what is SOUTHCOM. SOUTHCOM is Southern Command, Southern American Command of the U.S. Pentagon. And what they're doing, effectively, is trying to control the whole of South America using this. But it's not just there, is it? They've got other commands in other parts of the world, Martin.
Well, they basically, the whole of the world is divvied up between different US military structures.
We've got SOUTHCOM in the Middle East.
Yes, well, AFRICOM was interesting because most African countries saying, well, we don't need an AFRICOM. So they weren't allowed to base it anywhere. They were trying to get a base for it somewhere in South Africa, but they couldn't find one.
It sounds to me like the Americans want to take over the world.
They do. That's quite clear. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, and as a result of 9/11, which we're going to come to later, the strategy of the US ruling class is full-spectrum dominance. They want to run the entire world. They won't accept anybody else as an alternative power source, whether that be the Chinese, the Russians, the Brazilians, the Venezuelans, anybody. It's absolutely mad, because, of course, what should be happening is everybody should be negotiating a multipolar world order.
I mean, if there is a
but
third
we're not
world
doing
war,
that.
It seems pretty clear how it's panning out. I mean, it would be probably started between some flashpoint, whether in Eastern Europe or in the Middle East, between the US and Russia. And then, after a while, it's quite clear that the Chinese would come in on the side of the Russians. Is that...
Well, the Chinese have sent ships to the Baltic to engage with...
Well, had just this week, and we've had no news about it here, a Chinese naval base, the first one ever, opening in Djibouti.
Djibouti, yeah. But at the same time, it's actually a military base in Djibouti. It's not a naval base, it's an army base.
For refueling ships.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, Djibouti has got bases, US bases, Chinese bases, French bases. So they've got everybody's bases are in Djibouti.
Well, we hear a lot about the Straits of Hormuz, but not so much about the Bab al-Mandeb Strait.
No, well, all of these.
That's where Djibouti is.
Yes,
basically.
That's right.
It controls that strait.
That's right.
Which is, it's basically like the bottom end of the Suez Canal.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we're shaping up for a World War III style contest. It's not, I mean, we've just sent our aircraft carriers with no aircraft on to go and trail their coats in the South China Sea and dare the Chinese to attack them. That's what they're for. We're opening a new naval base in Bahrain. We've got no money for schools and hospitals in this country, but we're opening a whole new naval base in Bahrain. But failing to notice that our Bahrain was a British colony till 1971. We handed it over to the Al Khalifa family, who are a Sunni monarchy that we created. But the majority of people in Bahrain are actually Shia, and they don't want the Khalifa family, and they don't want our naval base.
Well, it's nice to know where our taxpayers' money's going. Anyway,
that's
Martin,
right.
Well, let's have a little listen now, because I think it's really important to kind of get our heads around who this guy is who's taken over at the White House as the chief of staff there, particularly because he's got rid of old Mr. Scaramucci, the mafia man from Wall Street, who's in there. Even he is not good enough for this new guy,
Scaramucci,
John
was just Scaramucci was just a communications chief. This guy is a chief of staff.
Well, he's the one who hires and fires all of these people. And yeah. as we'll hear a bit later, it may be that there's very few Trump supporters left. Anyway, so who is General John Kelly? He's involved in Southcom, and here he is talking about how, as part of the chief of Southcom, he was very much concerned with human rights in South America.
The U.S. military, throughout our history, does human rights. It is fundamental to who we are. It is fundamental to how we operate. I don't need a lawyer to tell me what human rights are. I know what it is because I was raised properly. My mother taught me about how to deal with people. And entering the military in my whole life in the military has been one devoted to first and foremost human rights. Everything we do in Southern Command, and as Alyssa mentioned, down in Southern Command, we are the only, in fact, they're small but powerful, but my human rights team is here. The United States Southern Command, one of five overseas commands that our nation has, our team is the only only combatant command that has a dedicated human rights office. And as I say, they're small, but they're extremely powerful. And they have connections throughout not only the U.S. end of the human rights community, but also down in the various countries that we interact in. So as I say, we don't talk about it, we do it. And I will not deal with anyone, nor will my people deal with anyone, that is trying to BS us relative to how they treat their people. I've got a lot of experience in Iraq. Well, I've got a lot of experience in a lot of different places. This isn't anything new to me. As I said, from the day I became a private in the Marine Corps, left the enlisted ranks as a sergeant, became a second lieutenant all the way up through four stars, it is what we do in the military. And in, from the very, very beginning, all through our careers, we're trained to first and foremost think about what we're going to do, whether it's deliver artillery fires, airstrikes, or simply engage in a country in Latin America, that everything we do be done legally and according to the law of war, obviously, but most importantly, that we're doing the right thing.
Well, isn't that extraordinary? Because both in Honduras and in Paraguay, the Obama regime supported coups against the democratically elected governments, and those coup regimes are still in power. Also, they've supported the legal coup against the elected president of Brazil. And they're also funding the opposition in Venezuela, which has actually killed lots of police officers and soldiers. Maybe that's a good thing, but it's not. The record of the US in Latin America is completely the opposite of what he's just saying. But then, of course, Sitting Bull said, pale face speak with forked tongue. They promised to take, they made many promises, they didn't keep any of them, except they promised to take our land, and they took it. And he is another one. I mean, one of the things about US political discourse is that everybody pats themselves on the back continuously about how good they are, and how worthy they are, and how they're not pursuing just their material interests, but they've got these huge humanitarian goals. It's rather sick-making when you actually look at the history.
Well, it's a bit like the mainstream media, that, actually, as well. Lots of backpatting goes on there, too. Martin, also, of course, he's talking about, oh, yeah, everything I do is super legal, and yet he was involved in the Iraq War.
Indeed, where General Petraeus set up a whole series of death squads run out of the Interior Ministry, which are still operational, and it's what they called the Salvador option. Of course, in the 1980s, the Western powers, the United States, supported the regime in El Salvador. They tried to overthrow the democratically elected government of Nicaragua. It was twice democratically elected. The way they did that was supplying cocaine to the streets of the United States of America via Mena Air Base in Arkansas. They then got loads of weaponry sent out so that 30,000 civilians could be killed, and eventually they got the result they wanted, and the Sandinistas lost an election
in
Nicaragua.
General John Kelly very much bemoans the amount of drug trafficking that's going on between South America and the US.
Well, that's very strange, because in actual fact the CIA have been involved in that drug traffic, and it's been proved to be the case.
Well, that's the CIA, that's not him, is it?
Well, the CIA is another part of the US government, and the Pentagon and the CIA don't exactly have the same interests. They do, in fact, fight each other, but they're both, in fact, engaged in trying to push the interests of a criminalised ruling class. A criminalised ruling class inside the United States of America and a criminalised ruling class inside Latin America. So Uribe, who is their big puppet in Colombia, although he's on the margin now, not entirely, he was named as one of the top drug traffickers in the world, but he was working very closely with the CIA and the Pentagon. And all the evidence suggests that they have been deeply involved. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, who's a big hero on TV in America, but it's quite clear he was involved in massive drug trafficking and terrorism involving killing thousands of civilians, but they still come on and tell us how wonderful they are and how human rights is so important to them. Ridiculous.
He's the perfect candidate. I bet he gets pats on the back both from the TV producers and from the military.
Well, indeed, if there was any justice, he should have been sent to prison for 25 years with no parole. But of course, far from that, he's actually a well-regarded figure. Ronald Reagan is still regarded in middle America as a great hero, but he presided over all of this, the drug explosion inside the inner cities, all done through MENA Air Base. The Clintons were involved in that. I'm afraid the CIA and the Pentagon have, when they talk about human rights, it's just a hollow nonsense, really.
So, BS, would you call it?
I think that's what they call it in the US.
Okay. General John Kelly, in the same speech, said he was actually tackled by some human rights campaigners in South America.
Human rights representative came at me, was hostile in the extreme. US military is nothing but bad. You shouldn't be here. Why are you here? And this might surprise you, but the vast majority of what I do, what we do in the Caribbean and Latin America, and I mean the vast majority, has nothing to do with guns, nothing to do with fighting, patrolling, teaching them tactics. It's overwhelmingly humanitarian assistance and teaching them things like disaster relief in the event of an earthquake or a hurricane, and frankly, engineering work where we'll fix a school, drill a well, fix a dam. Very, very little, in the big scheme of things, very, very little what most people would think of is military. Challenges in the region, various challenges. The good news is democracy in many, many places where there hasn't been a tradition of democracy, democracy is growing. One thing that does cause me a great deal of concern, some countries are backsliding. I won't get into which ones, you know who they are. But they've gone from being fairly democratic over the last 10 or 15 years, 20 years, and now seem to be backsliding a little bit for various reasons.
Well, he's not mentioning Honduras and Paraguay there, where the US administration supported military coups, which then ended up with people being assassinated and killed, tortured. He's not mentioning what he means by that is Venezuela. Who are the bad boys on the block? That's what he means by that. We know who they are. We don't know who they are. Most people, and of course, the idea that the U.S. military are involved in handing out sweeties and being kind to everybody. I mean, the indigenous person that he mentioned was asking a perfectly legitimate question: what are you doing here at all? What if the Russians were to turn up and say, we're going to build some dams, we're going to put sink some wells, we're the Russian military, we're just here to help? Do you think the Americans would be happy with that? Would they accept that as a legitimate... Well, the Russians are here to help everybody.
He's talking about democracy backsliding. But he's not talking about the United States, is he?
Well, no, because in actual fact, what's going on both in the United States and Latin America is democracy is being hollowed out by criminal oligarchy. And they're linked. They're linked both in every possible way. This criminal oligarchy is in fact, you know, they're married to each other. They have close relations with each other. And this is, I mean, frankly, anybody who knows anything about Latin American politics, and many people in Latin America obviously do, they would find this guy's statements absurd. You are a military person. There's a very serious question. What are you doing here at all? Why are you here at all? You're supposed to be defending the United States of America. Here you are supposedly building dams and wells for poor people in rural Colombia, for example. Although in actual fact, they've been training the Colombian army, which is notorious for human rights abuses of a most egregious kind.
None of this gets a challenge, does it, really, in the mainstream press in Britain, it doesn't, or anywhere else?
Well, I mean, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning in Georgia trained all virtually all of the torturers during
the day. There's no criticism of this in the mainstream press.
Well, no, because most people don't really know much about Latin America. It's actually a rather exotic place, which is regarded as America's backyard. So what they do there, we don't know, and we don't ask.
We heard about Venezuela sanctions this week. There's also been Russian sanctions. A sheepish looking President Trump, after having campaigned on a ticket of rapprochement with Russia, signs another whole load of economic sanctions. And as we have said several times, the Saker, who was a US, actually, no, he wasn't. He's not American.
Swiss.
He was a military advisor. I think he's actually born in Russia. But anyway, he was an advisor for the United Nations, has broken down modern warfare into 80% psychological, that is using the media of various sorts, books, newspapers, magazines, all that stuff, 20% economic and only 15% economic and only 5% fighting. But this week we've seen Vladimir Putin expelling 755 US diplomats from Russia after this new Russian sanctions law has been signed into law by Trump.
Well, I mean, the Russians have been very, very patient with the attitude of the ruling circles in the United States. They've been hoping for some common sense from them for a long time.
It sounds a lot, the 755, but apparently it's only bringing them down to the same level.
Well, that's right, because loads of Russians were kicked out as Obama was leaving office. And on that occasion, Putin, Lavrov and others in the Russian Federation took the view that we'll wait and see what the new guy is going to do. We're not just going to do tit for tat here. That's silly. But now, if you really are just determined to pick a fight with us, then we haven't got much choice except to pick up the battle.
Anyway, very few critical voices are anywhere in the Western press, the mainstream press, which suggests to me that war is actually getting closer, Martin. Because
it is.
No, all we're getting is propaganda. There's no countervailing voice, the sort of thing you'll hear on here. But anyway, let's have a listen to one of those countervailing voices, which is on the band in Britain, Press TV, the Iranian state broadcaster. And they're not squeaky clean by any means this week. Amnesty have brought out a report about that we're hearing about in a minute, but his name is James Jatras, and he's a former US Senate foreign policy advisor.
Mr. Jatras, do you think Madrid is correct in saying that this is tantamount to a full-scale trade war?
Well, I think Mr. Medvedev is overly optimistic. If it were just a trade war, that would be bad enough, but this is more than that. This is essentially carving into stone a new Cold War with Russia that will go on for a long time, maybe for decades. Even we can be optimistic enough that the worst doesn't happen, that the Cold War doesn't turn hot. As far as the Trump administration being powerless, I think it's even worse than that. And not only is Congress solidly against Mr. Trump in terms of any possibility of improving ties with Moscow, even most of his administration is against it as well. There are reports now about how all sorts of never-Trumpers and neoconservatives are staffing the Trump administration, and anybody who is a Trump loyalist is simply not welcome in the administration. I think what we need to look at is the bigger picture, the fact that this is not militarily but politically a declaration of war on Russia. There will be very little in the way of cooperation. There will be confrontation. The only bright spot on the horizon has been the Russian-American agreement about Syria and Mr. Trump's stopping aid to the terrorist groups there. And frankly, I think that's on pretty thin ice too now.
For the rest of the Trump presidency, then, Mr. Jatras, what should we expect? Because, you know, Trump came into office at the very least wanting better relations with Russia.
I think what we'll see is essentially the kind of policy we would have gotten if Hillary Clinton had won, which would have been a full pressure on Russia, an attempt to destroy Russia's economy, an attempt to block Russia from the world financial system, with the notion that eventually this will result in regime change. And look, you hear people on the media all the time here. We have to crush Russia. We have to force them to change their government, get rid of Putin. This is the kind of mindset they have, and they don't seem to understand they're dealing with a major nuclear superpower. They're not talking about Syria or Serbia or Libya or a country like that, even a country much more powerful than Iran. Reality simply does not enter into their consciousness.
Well, that sounds to me like a very sober but correct analysis of where we're going.
Why aren't we hearing that analysis, though? Because really, we've heard none, really, particularly looking at the military moving into the White House and taking over, and also about the hostility between many of the people that are now staffers in the White House and Trump. We're hearing very little about that, and also very little about the exchange between the US and Russia.
Well, I mean, the fact is that the oligarchy controls the media, controls the secret services, controls the military, and they control the narrative insofar as they can. You know, us banging on about, you know, more different perspectives on radio stations like this doesn't stop them, does it?
Also, Press TV banned. I mean, this is also a bit worrying because they've also been sanctioned, etc. as well. So how does Iran fit into all this?
Well, it's pretty clear that because he's in the pocket of the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, Trump wants a war with Iran. And that's what the Israelis have been saying that for years. We want a war with Iran. We want a war with Iran. And of course, what happens in the British media is we're told, oh, well, they don't really mean
that.
Well,
that could be a nuclear war.
Of course it could.
The teeth with these nuclear... Actually, I was...
Well, no, the Iranians aren't armed with...
Israelis are armed to the teeth with...
Yes, they are.
I was just looking at a documentary the other day.
They're not supposed to have them, but they've got them.
About the Germans supplying them with these Dolphin-class submarines that can take these nuclear-armed cruise missiles and fire them anywhere in the world.
Yep,
hydrogen bombs.
That's right.
And neutron bombs.
Well, Martin von Creveld, who's a defence intellectual in Israel, made a statement some years ago saying what our allies in the West have got to realise is that we've got nuclear weapons and we can nuke Berlin, Rome, or Paris if we want to, and they've said that. And, of course, they're not supposed to have any nuclear weapons at all. Under the Logan Act, if it was proven and they came out and said, yes, we've got nuclear weapons, then all aid and trade with Israel would have to stop. They haven't signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Why not? That's because they've basically stolen their nuclear weapons from the Americans and they're blackmailing the world.
Well, the French helped them, I think, didn't they?
Well, and the British too, no doubt.
The Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is under investigation for bribery. An Israeli court said that two police investigations involving Netanyahu could result in corruption charges. Prosecutors are also believed to be in talks with one of Netanyahu's former top aides about testifying against him.
Well, the state of Israel, I read some years ago, 40% of the economy is controlled by Russian mafia interests. What we've got to realise is that the people running the show at the top in the US, in Israel, in Britain, because of the City of London and all the rest of it, they are a criminalised oligarchy. And these are the kind of people that have been in power in Latin America for many, many years. Even when you've got left-leaning governments, these people still have an awful lot of power.
Well, looking at the opposite side in Iran, before we get to the Amnesty report, there's a fascinating piece by Kim Sengupta just yesterday in the Independent Online. Iran election and Qatar crisis setting the Middle East on edge as the Saudi Arabia seeks to extend its influence. And the US in particular must strike a difficult balance in a region going through a volatile period. He's saying, it's just quoting, I'll just do the quote then give the guy's name. Some of the Saudi funded mosques in the UK are as dangerous as many mosques in Saudi Arabia, and the UK has suffered because of that. We've seen the Saudis spreading the extremist Wahhabi form of Islam in other parts of the world, and highly damaging effect of that as well, said Mohammed Marandi, who's an academic with influence in Iran's governing circles. He's speaking about the state of power play in the Middle East, which is going through a particularly volatile point, even with by its turbulent standards, with repercussions spreading far beyond.
Well, yes, and of course we've got all of these conflict points around the world, and any one of which could lead to World War III, and when you've got five or six boiling simultaneously, the likelihood is we're going to get scalded.
So let's have a look at this Amnesty report this week. They've called on the international community, in particular the European Union, to speak out against the outrageous treatment of human rights activists in Iran. In a damning report published this week on Wednesday, Amnesty said Iran's judicial and security bodies have waged a vicious crackdown on human rights defenders since Hassan Rouhani became president in 2013, demonising and imprisoning activists. The report, entitled Caught in a Web of Repression, Iran's Human Rights Defenders Under Attack, and I'll put a link into that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, details how scores of activists, often labelled foreign agents and traitors by the state media, have been prosecuted and jailed on spurious national security charges. It's a bitter irony as the Iranian authorities boast about their increased engagement with the UN and the EU, particularly in the aftermath of the nuclear deal. Human rights defenders who've made contact with these same institutions are being treated, Martin, as criminals.
Well, I'd be the last one to defend the Iranian regime's repression of those who are genuine human rights activists. But I do have to point out that the Iranians are probably the only country in the Middle East that has democratic elections in which the majority participate. There hasn't been a democratic election in Saudi Arabia ever. And there's 30,000 political prisons inside Saudi Arabia, even though they've got a much smaller population than Iran. And these people are tortured, murdered at will, and we carry on selling them weapons, and that and Amnesty does, to be fair, try to be even-handed. But at the same time, they can also be manipulated. Why is it... in Iran, they have democratic elections. Rouhani's just been re-elected.
Martin, let me just... But
with majority support.
Report, yeah? Some activists, the report said, have been sentenced to more than 10 years behind bars for simple acts such as being in contact with the UN, the EU, or human rights organisations, including Amnesty. The report highlights 45 cases, including anti-death penalty campaigners, women's rights activists, trade unionists, minority rights activists, human rights lawyers, and activists seeking truth, justice, and reparation for mass extrajudicial executions and enforced disappearances in the 1980s. Now, don't these people deserve to be free, not in jail?
I would probably agree with you, Tony, but as you went to a conference in Tehran not that long ago where they talked about terrorism against the Iranian state, where 17,000 people, civilians, have been killed by terrorists in Iran since the revolution. 17,000. And that is actually supported by Saudi Arabia. The attack on the Khomeini mausoleum killed 12 civilians. That was several weeks ago. And Trump said, oh, that's what you get if you support terrorism. So there was no sympathy for the Iranians there. No, let's work together to stop terrorism.
So is Trump going to get his war with Iran?
If the Israelis have their way, very definitely. But
so
of course,
are the Israelis actually running American foreign
policy?
Yes,
that's the implication of this vote. The AIPAC,
the biggest, most powerful. Nobody
gets elected to the US Congress without money from AIPAC, which is actually money. It's actually US taxpayers' money, which has been given to Israel, which is then used to buy politics back in the US. And they decide the policy, and Trump is very much in their pocket. And they're very happy with the way that things are going. Trump's one rebellious thought was to try and talk sensibly to the Russians. That's now been squashed. So we're all ready for World War III. But of course, I would say to the right wing in Israel and elsewhere, and right wings in the United States of America, and this is what the Russian general staff would say, we've never been beaten. Never. Not in World War I, not in the Napoleonic Wars, not in World War II. You attack us, you will lose. And unless with the nuclear war, which we all die, which is perfectly possible, it's quite possible that World War III will take place and the Western oligarchy will have its back broken permanently. I hope so.
Also this week, the Saudis have been asking a US judge to drop lawsuits over the 9/11 attacks. Saudi Arabia asked a US judge to dismiss lawsuits that hold Riyadh responsible for the September the 11th, 2001 attacks and seek damages for the victims. Lawyers representing Saudi Arabia made the request in papers filed with Manhattan Federal Court on Tuesday this week, arguing the plaintiffs had so far failed to generate sufficient evidence to subject the kingdom to the $100 billion lawsuit.
Yeah, well, there was a legal judgment in the US that the Iranians should have to pay compensation for 9/11, even though there's no suggestion that the Iranians had anything to do with it. So we're in crazy world. We're in bizarro world, really. What it looks like, 9/11 was an inside job by the US security forces working with the Saudis and the Israelis and no doubt MI6. That's what the Russian general staff believe. General Ivashov was in command of the Russian armed forces on the day. People can look up his views.
Martin, the long and short of this, of course, is that 9/11 has led to all these massive interventions around the world by the NATO countries, mainly by the US. If World War III does break out, where's your best guess?
Well, the likely place is going to be Syria. But, of course, they're now talking about providing anti-tank and anti-aircraft weaponry to Kiev. So that's another place where it could kick off. The South China Sea, North Korea. One thing I think we can state fairly clearly that it probably won't be Latin America that kicks it off, but Latin America has got its own cross to bear.
So how on earth did we get here? The answer, of course, is 9/11, as we were saying earlier. And we're doing a series of talks and interviews about 9/11 on the run-up to the 16th anniversary, and we have a special just the Friday before that. But this week we're going to have a listen to a guy called William Stewart, who's written a book back in 2012 called 9/11 to Armageddon, bankers plan wars.
What I'd like to look at is the event of 9/11 itself and see whether that's a genuine attack from overseas or whether it's something else. 8:45, September 11, 2001, and flight 11 out of Boston slammed into one of the towers. And we all know the carnage and the horror that was to follow that. When we begin to look at the event of 9/11, there are quite a lot of surprises. For instance, a team called Able Danger had found the flyers and Mohammed Atta, the supposed leader of it all, in January of 2000. They were blocked by the FBI, by military intelligence, and told not to investigate. Senator Spector asked the Pentagon chief of intelligence what had happened to the large amounts of documentation on the Atta team, and he said it was all deleted. He was asked the question again, he just said, yeah, we deleted it all. When one of the actual flyers turned himself in, he was sent home. Somebody called Randy Glass also found out about the towers and wrote to Senator Graham. He was told they knew all about the planes, although planes had not been mentioned by Glass. When Glass wrote in again, he was told to keep quiet.
When you say one of the flyers, were you talking about a supposed terrorist?
Yes, indeed. The team that was supposed to have flown the planes into the towers.
And he was presumably sent back to his native country?
He was indeed. Now, it's pretty certain that these terrorists, who were supposed to be flying big jets, had no flying skills at all. And yet, when you look at the event of the planes striking the towers, it's obvious that whatever was flying them, or whoever was flying them, had to be extremely skilled. So we start turning up a few little problems here. At the time, there were airliners being flown by radio control. They just developed that in the early parts of 2001. So the question is whether, in fact, there was a bit more going on. And the GPS signal around the towers was at level 10 and not at 4 as usual. So this is a very strange event, suggesting something very important was being played out. But then we have to add another little complex bit in that aircraft do not bring down steel buildings. And the aircraft are, in a sense, irrelevant to what happened, although they did provide a mask for the real perpetrators. When you've got a steel cage building, which is proofed against fire, it doesn't come down when an aircraft hits it. As well as the Arab team from Saudi Arabia, the flyers themselves, there were plenty of Israeli activity. It's probable that the young movements, Hamas and for Israel Irgun, was the source of two teams operating in America. But it's not entirely certain that they are to be seen as the prime culprits for what happened. Israelis and Arabs from Saudi Arabia might have been part of the demolition of these buildings, but of course something else exploded in the Twin Towers, according to those who have looked under the surface. An Israeli phone, in fact, moved out of the Twin Towers a week before the strike, and at least two Israelis we know were warned 2 hours before the event. So there's an awful lot of knowledge about. A retired Israeli Defense Force officer heard the Twin Towers strike being discussed in a Jewish cemetery in October of 2000 and told the FBI. So there are lots of things going on here, a certain amount of common knowledge and definite scientific doubt about the outcome, which was the fall of those towers. It's also been noticed that at the Trade Center there was a van and three Israelis were standing on top of it and dancing for absolute joy as the towers collapsed. So there was this sort of feeling that somehow it might be like the Irgun looking forward to rapture and the sort of Armageddon scenario that brings forward the State of Israel. Pershenik, the Patriot Games character who became Jack Ryan on the film, advisor to five presidents, stated 9/11 was to mobilize into war. The military responsible are known to me and I to them. The CIA, Wolfowitz, Cheney, Hadley, Ross, Rice, Air Force generals, intel, CIA ops were involved. It was a false flag, a lie, and the 9/11 commission that looked at it was just nonsense. Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice should have been put on trial with Abrahams and Wolfowitz and more. He stated on radio and TV that he wanted a trial at which he would give testimony. Now he's on film, he's on radio, and so you have to put that into the mix of what is going on here. He stated that if FBI agents got close, they were blocked by their bosses. So in other words, an insight into what happened with intelligence services at this time, that they were being blocked in certain ways, probably towards the top, if not at the top, but they were doing their job as you would expect them to do. Now, the CIA had an asset called Susan Linda, and she was locked up for a year following these events and was very nearly given a chemical lobotomy to suggest that she was mad. She was basically just under the various laws that had been changed there, was just locked up like that and taken out of commission. And her boss, according to her, was bribed with millions to keep quiet. And she stated very clearly that a thermite bomb was used on the buildings and that this was a USA military weapon. Well, somebody else might have one, but it was a very special kind of weapon, highly advanced, and does not get into buildings unless it is placed there. Now, she was quite senior in her way. She was chief asset for Iraq, Libya, Yemen, Syria, Egypt, Malaysia. And she was told to tell Saddam Hussein months before 9/11 that if he didn't say who was behind the 9/11 plot, he would be bombed back into the Stone Age and hit harder than ever before. As Susan pointed out, he wanted peace and had opened up massive trade deals for America. So we're beginning to see another side of America. You're beginning to see a person who really, I suppose, invented PSYOPs, Moshenik, and you're beginning to see a senior CIA asset speaking on radio, speaking on film, on video, and saying something that, you know, many of us will not have heard. That when you get these peaks of power in America, it goes straight across into places like Frankfurt and Switzerland. So don't let's say that America is responsible for what happened in America. It's much more complex than that, and it's beginning to look very much as though this ghastly event was arranged by people who were only using America for their own purposes. Now, in the towers, there were hundreds of witnesses to explosions, and you've only got, well, in fact, I've put quite a lot of them in the book, but you've only got to look at that to realise there's something terribly wrong here. This included the police and the fire services, and some of these explosions were very clearly witnessed. There are three firemen, and they're on tape suggesting that there was an explosion in the lobby. They said it was horrible, and they were asked, was this a secondary explosion? And they said, yes, there was definitely a second explosion. On our way upstairs, the whole thing blew. There were three explosions after the plane hit. Now, police, firemen, civilians, news all said the same thing, and indeed there are actually recordings of explosions in the buildings. So buildings do not collapse because a plane hits them. And steel does not give way when treated against fire, as in the case of the Trade Center buildings. In any case, the towers fell into their own footprint in complete freefall, so someone took out the basement network of steel girders. Otherwise, this would not happen. Danish scientist Niels Harrit, Copenhagen University, found nanothermite material attached to the twin tower wreckage. This material melts metal and blows it apart, so it's both an explosive and it also melts it. He found tiny red chips of unreacted thermite, just as Susan, that's the CIA asset, had said. These bits had not gone off, and the city department staff stated the steel was bursting into flames, welding itself onto other steel, flowing in channels and pooling, and even melting the workers' boots. So nine scientists found thermite as unreacted pyrotechnic explosives. Kevin Rahn lost his job as a lab director for writing a report that said aircraft fuel could not have done it. And when we look at Building 7, this was a planned demolition. The building moved inward at the top and collapsed at high speed into its own footprint. It was in freefall, which meant all its central columns had been taken out. It wouldn't do it otherwise. You might get some odd circumstance whereby a little bit of the building came down, but this went straight down into its footprint. It was timed in seconds and it was a complete freefall. May have seen or may not have seen the tape where it is stated that a fireman was saying the building will be coming down, appeared to be giving a countdown, and then said quite audibly on the video, run for your lives. This is recorded, of course. Then there was a huge boom that buckled the windows and shook the ground. So I would agree with what you're saying. There was a fire could burn for days on end and not actually bring the building down. The damage it received was not particularly bad. But that's not what happened, is it? The building had no steel network at its base and just went down into its own footprint. And the seconds of the fall have been properly gauged. So there we come up with lots of different ideas, but I think the whole thing is beginning to point to something else. And so, in a sense, you need the book to see what I've said and to see whether the reasoning is correct or not. I can only sort of skate over things. And then we come to the Pentagon. And, you know, if one bit of 9/11 wasn't quite correct, then possibly all of it isn't quite correct. Flight 77 is supposed to have flown into the Pentagon, but it left no proper debris. There's no engines. They were huge, of course. No engines. Seats, tailplane missing. Bodies, they're missing too. The engines would, in fact, on the flight path it was supposed to be on, would have ripped up the lawn. The wings themselves would have torn into the building, which, if you look at photographs of it, you'll see there are no marks of any wings there at all. So the whole thing is beginning to look extremely shaky. It was very clearly not on the flight path suggested by the black box. In fact, many reliable people, from flyers to police, saw this flight 77 on a different course altogether, and the plane was seen by a policeman as it flew away from the Pentagon anyway. Now, we know that two objects hit the Pentagon. One was thought to be an unmanned drone, which seems to have struck slightly after a very bright flash, possibly a rocket strike, with the great possibility that explosives also were in the Pentagon and set to destroy various records of trillion-dollar fraud. All the films of this event have disappeared, and now you know how many security cameras you have around these sort of areas. Only one film has been handed back, as far as I know at the moment, and experts have said that the frame or frames have been removed, so that the object that actually struck the Pentagon could not be identified. Now, all these things have got to be sort of thought out, and you have to ask the question why people would be wanting to hide this if they themselves have nothing to hide.
Good question. That's the author of the book 9/11 to Armageddon, Bankers Plan Wars, from 2012. His name's William Stewart Martin.
Yeah, I mean, that was a pretty good summary of many of the things that have been said. He said there were three Israelis dancing. I think there were five, and they eventually came up on Israeli television and said we were just documenting the event, documenting supposed surprise attack. I think to summarise, I would say if people have not looked into 9/11, they should look at the video of WTC-7 collapse. Just put WTC-7 into your search engine, and you'll see the third building that collapsed, which no plane hit. So no plane hit it, so there's no explanation that the fires could have been that could have been brought down by a plane fire. And the other question that people have to ask themselves is, where was the United States Air Force for 2 hours? When you have a Russian bomber coming in over the North Sea, it takes minutes, less than minutes, for the RAF to scramble. We've got four planes flying around, not even flying directly to the targets, flying around all over the place inside US airspace, the most heavily defended airspace in the world around the Pentagon, and no interceptions at all. Is that credible?
A stand down by Dick Cheney, perhaps?
Well, indeed, but if people go, and I went to see the film Dunkirk recently, in which the RAF were given a reasonably good bill of health, you know, because they were criticised at the time. Where was the United States Air Force, the most expensive air force in the world, defending the most heavily defended building in the world? I mean, in actual fact, the Pentagon, I understand, has missiles around it, which are supposed to shoot down anything that comes anywhere near it. Somebody switched them off, didn't they?
Okay, so I'll put a link to that book on our show page.
And put a link to the WTC-7 video.
At thisweek.org.uk. Martin, final question. If this World War III does kick off in Syria or Ukraine, how could that possibly happen in a way that could convince the Western public that it was just war?
I think what's beginning to happen is that they've not achieved their targets. If you look at the project for a new American century, they were supposed to have achieved their various goals by now, just like the German general staff in World War II. World War III's already started. We're perhaps a third of the way through it, but the oligarchs in the West that started it have not achieved their goals. And, you know, if we go to the next phase now, the counterattack may begin.
How are you going to answer my question or not?
Well, what is the question?
The question was, how would they convince the Western public that such a war could possibly be just?
Well, I'm pretty confident that, for example, the Russian general staff have got a lot more information about 9/11 than they've used. They very rarely speak about it. But one of the first things they'll do as they start shooting down planes and killing people is they'll bet it, make sure it's all out there, the overwhelming information that shows that it was an inside job by the West.
Will the internet be working at that point?
Well, they'll probably try and close it down, but that it may be too late.
And blame that on the Russians.
Yes, maybe.
Okay. Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook. It's Arabian Nights, hopefully. With Mohammed Mukawi, thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour MP for Bristol North West, Darren Jones. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialect hears from Bristol Radical History's Mark Steeds this week about the Bristol Slavery History Hub projected. And also E. Michael Jones, who we didn't have time for again, he's on there too. Catch it online at dialectradio.co.uk or on this station, BCFM 93.2 at noon on Tuesday. This show's story links and comment page is thisweek.org.uk. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car, iPlayer, or anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy Quain's Saturday edition tomorrow morning at 10, and Get the Real Musical Deal Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. I'll leave you with music from 1990. That is America number one from Consolidated. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously. America number one is the title of it.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.